Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. On December 6, 1941, 80% of the American people wanted to stay out of the war in Europe. On December 7, 1941, Japanese planes attacked the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, which led to America's entry into the Second World War against the Axis powers. Here to explain how and why that happened is Robert Stinnett. He's a media fellow at the Independent Institute in Oakland, California. He's a former journalist and photographer for the Oakland Tribune, earned 10 battle stars and a presidential unit citation while in the United States Navy from 1942 through 46, and is the author of the book Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. Welcome to the show, Mr. Stinnett.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You were in the Navy during World War II. Was that in the Atlantic or in the Pacific?
In the Pacific.
And when did you begin to investigate unofficial truths about the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Well, it wasn't until 1982 that I became interested in it, because I had read a book that we had a cryptographic monitor station at in Honolulu prior to Pearl Harbor, and it was intercepting the messages of the Japanese fleet. That was the first time I heard about it. So I went to my editor at the Oakland Tribune and asked to get in on that story.
And what did you find?
I contacted the U.S. Navy, and they did confirm that they had a monitor station. That's where they're intercepting the messages of the Japanese fleet prior to December the 7th. And actually, they had been listening to it for many months, and they were able to trace the organization for the attacks on Pearl Harbor, Wake, and Guam, and other U.S. and allied positions in the Pacific.
So it wasn't just the diplomatic codes that they had broken. They had broken actually all the Japanese naval codes as well.
That is right. Most of your listeners and those who read the history of the of World War II are sort of familiar with the breaking of the Japanese diplomatic codes. But what was kept secret from all of the investigations of Pearl Harbor was that we had also broken the Japanese military codes. That's the at least the Navy codes, and most likely the Army codes also. Though I've concentrated on the Japanese naval codes that were used to organize the attack on our bases there in the Pacific.
When you were a sailor back during World War II, what did you believe was the best intelligence of enemy ship movements?
Well, I believed all of the information that was released at that time, that that the Japanese fleet was on radio silence and was not detected approaching Pearl Harbor or Guam or Wake or any of the other U.S. bases there in the Central Pacific. And it wasn't until 1982 that I learned different, and that's when I started the pursuit trying to get the truth of this momentous accomplishment of our cryptographers.
How many died at Pearl Harbor?
There was 2,500 soldiers and sailors, Marines, and civilians that were killed. That's in round numbers, and there were hundreds more injured.
Well, if our government had broken all the codes and knew that the Japanese Navy was on its way to attack Pearl Harbor, why didn't they stop them?
Well, the entire plan was to get Japan, militarists, to seize control of the Japanese government and attack us at Pearl Harbor. And we provoked them into doing that. We cut off their oil. And the reason for that was to trigger a treaty that the Japan, Germany, and Italy had signed called the Tripartite Pact. And that was signed in September 1940. And about 10 days later, the U.S. Navy came up with a plan to trigger that pact by using 8 provocations against Japan that the author of the said would cause them to institute an overt act of war against the United States. And that was what the entire U.S. strategy. And the idea was to get us in war with Germany, which is the real enemy as far as U.S. Planning was concerned.
And in your book, you reproduce this memo by a naval intelligence officer named Arthur McCollum from October 7th, 1940. And it is, as you just said, an 8-point or 8 provocation plan to maneuver the Japanese into firing the first shot. What were those 8 steps?
Yes, that is correct. In our discussion here, I'm calling them provocations. He called them 8 actions that he said would cause Japan to commit an overt act of war. One of them was to one of the actions was to send U.S. Cruiser divisions into Japanese territory and provoke the Japanese with really invading their territory. Another was to send submarines squadrons into the Far East. And another was to give aid to China, which was at war with Japan at that time. Another was to cut off all oil supplies and embargo steel and war supplies for the Japanese economy and for their for their structure. Another was to get British and Dutch to join us in the same type of embargoes. And these were slowly instituted against Japan. And the final one was in July 1941, just about 5.5 months before Pearl Harbor, which was a total embargo. And our American cryptologists saw that as a Japan had no place to go but for war. But all this information was kept from the Hawaiian commanders. That was Admiral Husband Kimmel and General Walter Short, because we wanted this overt act of war to come and on Hawaii and enrage the American public so that we could trigger that tripartite pact that I mentioned.
Now, this 8-action memo, I have to say, my friend Anthony Gregory works at the Independent Institute in Oakland and has held this document in his hands and read it, too. How did you get this 8-action memo by Arthur McCollum?
Well, when I started research on this project in 1982 and in 83, I had asked to see all of the documents involving Japanese plans for attacking Pearl Harbor. And this was addressed to the U.S. Navy, who had custody of these records. But I was denied access to them until 1995. And at that time, the Navy did release thousands of documents. And on the very first day that I started on this, this McCollum memo came in one of the boxes. I had no idea it was there. It had never been reported in any of the investigations for Pearl Harbor, and there were about 9 of them. No other media or authors had written about them. So I came across that in the January 1995 and realized that if this was true and that I could document these provocations, that I had a real cause for the overt war action.
And did
so
you
that's
find...
how it pursued, and it took me all of 1995 to check out those 8 actions.
And you're saying that the United States government did indeed implement all 8 of the actions recommended in McCollum's memo.
That is right. And President Roosevelt authorize more his chief of naval operations or his army chief. And it's all documented in White House records, the Army records, and the Navy records, and State Department, FBI records also confirm this. They're all placed into effect.
Mr. Stinnett, you're making the case that the national government of the United States aided and abetted the mass murder, thousands of Americans, by foreign power. And yet, in your book, you say that you feel it was justified. How could this be?
Well, at the time, in fact, I documented in the book, there was an isolation movement in this country led by Charles Lindbergh, Henry Ford, the industrialist, Father Coughlin, who was a Catholic priest, who was a very popular radio priest, and others. There was a huge movement. 80% of Americans wanted nothing to do with Europe's war. The danger to our country was from Germany, and not so much from Japan, because Japan could be cut off at any time. And it was to end this isolation movement and get Japan to attack us, and then trigger that tripartite pact. It was a backdoor approach to war. And many people had suggested that was true during the investigations of the 1940s. But no one had the proof because it was all locked up in Navy vaults. And I was fortunate to be able to get these with the Freedom of Information Act in January 1995.
I'm sorry, sir, but the sacrifice of a few for the greater good seems a lot like the ideology that America was supposedly fighting in World War II.
Well, you're right. That is the premise was used in early in 1848 by President Polk in the Mexican War, where authors of including U.S. Grant, you know, the president who then was in the army, they provoked Mexican troops in starting the Mexican War, and then President Abraham Lincoln used the provocation policy at Fort Sumter. I think more people know about it, the USS Maine and the Havana Harbor in 1898 that got us the Spanish-American War. And it's a policy that's been used to...
The Lusitania as well,
various
right?
Times.
The Lusitania as well that got us into World War One.
Yes, right. There's another one. Yes, that's right.
And the Gulf of Tonkin and inviting Iraq into Kuwait. This sort of...
Absolutely.
Seems like we've been lied into every war since the war for Mexico.
At least, as far as the United States is concerned, and certainly the weapons of mass destruction is a provocation-type policy.
And for those interested in that, stay tuned in 15 minutes or so. We're going to be talking to Jude Winiski all about the Pearl Harbor version, or the Iraq version of the Pearl Harbor lie to get us to invade that country. In any case, I think we should get back a little bit more to the details here, Mr. Stinnett. In your book, you say that there were 36 men who were inside the loop and were allowed to read the transcripts of the decoded naval transmissions. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. There were probably many more because you have to include the operators, the intercept operators, the cryptographers that are actually intercepting these messages that were in Japanese Morse code, the dot dash. It's a dot dash system, but it's entirely different than the which we're all familiar with Morse code of the 1940 era. But these operators knew, as well as the leaders of our government at the time.
And you talk in your book about how the intercept stations that were picking up all this radio traffic from the Japanese were actually located all throughout the Pacific and even at Hawaii. And yet the commanders did not know while people below them were on the inside. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. And there were 25 monitor stations in the Pacific basin that went from the west coast of the United States up to Alaska and then down in China and in the Netherlands, the east East Indies and a British station at Singapore. All of these were monitoring the Japanese fleet frequencies and also the Japanese Army frequencies. So both the United States and Great Britain and the Dutch, because they controlled the Netherlands, East Indies at the time. So they were all listening to these messages. We had radio direction finders. We could locate the Japanese warships when they broke radio silence, and then you could locate them where they were in the Pacific.
So MacArthur at the Philippines, he knew that Pearl Harbor was about to be attacked himself.
Yes, he did, because his cryptographers were monitoring the Japanese Imperial Army radio frequencies, and they intercepted the message that the war would start on December 8th, so that was Tokyo time, or December 7th, Hawaii time.
And do you have proof in your declassified documentation that this information was being received at the highest levels of the military, or do you just know where it wasn't going?
Well, we know that it was received in Washington, D.C. at the U.S. Navy headquarters, but the information, quite a bit of it was sent to Hawaii, but it was intercepted by a person that President Roosevelt put in charge of intelligence there, so it would not go to Admiral Kimmel or General Short. But General MacArthur and his co-commander in the Navy in the Philippines, Admiral Hart, they were getting this information, so they knew about it.
Where were the G-men during all this?
The FBI?
Yeah.
They were really cut out of the loop. They were not allowed to, as far as I can see, there's no proof that the FBI saw these messages, because they were not in the loop, because J. Edgar Hoover, who was head of the FBI, would use the information and leak it to his favorite congressmen or senators for his own personal aggrandizement, you know. And
that was his proper jurisdiction, though, counterintelligence, right?
It was, but not in not military communications. He was not in the loop on that. They did not. The FBI was not. They didn't have the know-how to break those codes at that time.
Okay, this is the Weekend Interview Show. The guest is Robert Stinnett, author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. The website is weekendinterviewshow.com. We keep all the archives of all the previous interviews up there. And the guest this hour, wrapping up our interview with Robert Stinnett, author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. Now, we've learned here, Mr. Stinnett, that Admiral Kimmel and General Short, the commanders at Hawaii, were cut out of the loop. And even though people under them knew that the Japanese were coming to attack, they were not provided that information because the President of the United States wanted the attack by the Japanese to be a great success. So, as you say, to convince the people of the United States to go to war against the Germans. And my question is, what happened to Admiral Kimmel and General Short, who had been cut out of the loop?
They were, Admiral Kimmel and General Short, the Hawaiian commanders, were immediately charged or accused in the media and in Congress with a dereliction of duty, though no formal charges were ever brought against them. But they were really forced to resign their commands. And on December 16th, Admiral Kimmel was relieved as Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet. And then a week or so later, General General Short, he was relieved of his command as the Hawaiian Army. And Admiral Chester Nimitz took Admiral Kimmel's place. And I've forgotten the name of the Army general that took Short. But anyway, they, by the end of December 1941, they were gone.
Wasn't it Admiral Kimmel who demanded to be court-martialed so that he could have a chance to defend himself?
Yes, he and his he conducted a lifetime program to get a trial so that he could clear his name, and then he died and nothing was done, and his family continued this pursuit, and finally in October 2000, Congress did make a finding that that both Admiral Kimmel and General Short were not responsible for the attack, and they should be restored to their original ranks. It was a four-star Admiral Kimmel and a three-star Lieutenant General for Short. But it had to be signed, the order to do that had to be signed by then-President Bush or his, Clinton or Bush, but they declined to sign it.
How do you respond to your critics who charge you with conspiracy theory?
Well, in my book, I have a 70% approval rating, and it's about 30% of people don't accept this documentation. And some of them, some of the most crucial documents, these critics even rewrite. They forge the documents. For instance, on November 26th, when the Japanese carrier fleet departed Japan, the admiral in charge was in extensive communications with the Japanese submarine force and the forces that were going to invade the Wake and Guam. But they rewrite it and eliminate the fact that the commanders were in extensive communications with one another. Those are crucial documents for these extensive communications were picked up by our radio direction finders. They located the warships of the carrier force and the submarine force all proceeding towards the Pearl Harbor. That's
and all those documents are reproduced in the appendix of your book, Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Mr. Stinnett.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.